Hello, my name's Tracy Bleakley and I'm Chief Executive of Hospice UK. I'm delighted to introduce my guest today, Dr. Jamila Hussain, who is a palliative care doctor and NIHR clinical lecturer. And today we're going to talk about an editorial that Jamila wrote back in May with her colleagues, Dr. Jonathan Kaufman and Dr. Sabrina Badjoie. And it was about racism and palliative care. So welcome, Dr. Jamila Hussain.
Thanks, Tracy. Nice to be here.
Jamila, I'm really interested in what made you sit down in May with your colleagues and write this piece. What was it that you wanted to get across to the hospice and palliative care sector at the time?
I think for me personally, it was how COVID kind of really made me open my eyes to inequalities. And obviously, I have lived experience of this, went through university and you're taught about this somewhat and you see it in your day-to-day practice. But there was something about COVID for me personally where it really kind of highlighted the stark differences within the UK. So there was that element of it. And then there was the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter that really kind of, again, shone at a time where we were already seeing inequalities with COVID-19. Again, how race and racism can play a huge part in causing inequalities in a way that has been around for so long. It's so embedded, it's so systematic, and it can cause this feeling of helplessness. And I guess my response to that was partly, I need to understand this a bit better. I need to reflect on what I need to do and I guess what we need to do in palliative care. So that was a big driver. And I think the second big driver for me was I felt that there was a palpable silence within the palliative care community after George Floyd, where there was a lot of discussion about health inequalities generally in COVID and also race and racism generally, but there wasn't much conversation within the palliative care field about how this kind of manifests within our services and what we do, which is quite evident, but it's not really something that was spoken about.
In terms of talking about racism, I think for a lot of people, racism is something that is horrifying, it's hate crime, it's very overt and very deliberate and something that only terrible people would do. But actually you explain in your editorial that to some degree we all have the potential to be racist. And of course we've all lived and grown up in a society that is structurally racist. We have to accept that. How do we get over that?
I think firstly, recognising that it is difficult. I think I've reflected a lot on this issue and we've set up kind of a race equity group, which is basically a few of us from minority ethnic groups coming together and kind of sharing our experiences. And one of the things that we're really mindful of is just how difficult it is for people who are from the dominant culture. So here in the UK, that would be white British, to live in a society where you do have certain privileges because of your race. You might not want to contribute to that in that way, but by not being actively anti-racist, the status quo is that you get advantages which inevitably means other people are disadvantages. And that is such a difficult position to be in. And I think we call for allies to help us and support us because those individuals do have the power that other people don't have to influence change. Allies need support amongst other allies. So we're kind of working to think about how can we provide kind of an equally supportive group for allies, recognising that that is a difficult state to be in. In terms of getting over the shame, I guess it's kind of owning it and then seeing, well, what can I do practically? And that then brings us on to, you know, what actions are required. And they're difficult actions, but I think there are definite steps that we can do to kind of address the inequalities and inequities within palliative and end-of-life care. Absolutely, the moral imperative is that we do address it.
I wonder if to some extent we've got a bit of an advantage in hospice and palliative care because we already have difficult conversations, and talking about death puts you in a risky situation which a lot of society don't want to go into. We know we have to be very careful and very mindful with what we say, but I challenge anybody who works colleagues in hospice and palliative care not to have at least one example in the back of their mind where they walked out of the room and thought, oh, I got that horribly wrong. And, you know, we don't cancel ourselves. We don't shy away from it. Every single day, we aspire to be better. We reflect with our colleagues. We constantly work to talk about death and dying because we know we'll have a better society as a result. Do you think that we can take some of that learning into talking about race and racism?
Yeah, I think there's definite parallels there. And I think what we're good at in palliative care is, yeah, tackling a subject that is a taboo, doing it in a position where people are very vulnerable. So supporting them to feel less vulnerable and be able to have those conversations, and crucially, listening, because that's probably one of the most active things that we do is listen. And I would say from my experience that if you have experienced racism, you develop a radar for people who genuinely value diversity and inclusion and different ways of being and different cultures, and who are genuinely want to listen to you, and those who also find it very difficult to do that, even with the best of intentions. So creating that safe space to say, I genuinely want to listen and understand your story and therefore what I can do to support you, is a really, really important part of it.
I was very moved a few months ago. You said that you'd subconsciously always thought that when you needed palliative care, you wouldn't have as good an experience as somebody who was white, but you hadn't vocalised that or thought about it. And you talked about your experience as a child going into primary care with your mum and what you saw and what you experienced. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I remember going to the GP practice with my mum. She had six children. She didn't speak English very well, and her having to advocate for herself and her children and being dismissed as saying, well, you've brought several children to one appointment and you're asking me different things about them. But to get from our house to the GP practice cost a lot of money. And so how was she able to actually manage all those children at the same time in a way that disadvantaged herself? She would hold on to her own health issues before going when we desperately needed to go, and then would bring up her issues. And again, it comes back to that subtle sense. If I looked at what those GPs would have documented, you wouldn't have sensed the inequality, but you could sense in the room that we were considered as being burdens. If I went in now as an articulate healthcare professional able to give a clear history, I would have got a different level of support. Coming from an ethnic minority background, you only have one way of life where you are seen as being not necessarily treated as equal as everyone else. And I think a huge part of that is the intersection with coming from a deprived community, a community with poorer health literacy. And I think, but I'd also reflect on, there was one GP within our GP practice who was white, British and female, who would give those women from my community who didn't speak English well, who had large families, a lot of time. And so the women would be desperate to get an appointment with her. She treated them with respect, and they knew that if they went to see her, they would be waiting a long time because she took so long with everyone, but it was worth it for that dignity that it provided us. And there was a real sense of relief when we got an appointment with her. I've got a GP who's excellent clinically, is just fighting for that, being treated as someone who deserves to be treated as someone as equal as anyone else in society. And that really did imprint on my mind, and I guess it informs my practice now, that I know that those people who come from so-called disadvantaged backgrounds and communities, they come in from a more vulnerable position, and we need to work hard to say, look, I'm here for you, and I'm going to try and do my best to support you the best I can, and you deserve that.
And I was really struck by something that you said in the editorial around the fact that hospice and palliative care has largely been driven by very charismatic white individuals who've done amazing work, but it's also potentially given us the idea that the services designed for white, potentially middle-class people are the gold standard. and that anything else is an add-on, a nice to have, a something that needs additional work and consideration and time over and above all of the good work that's been done putting hospice and palliative care together, which almost makes it sound like an inconvenience in itself.
Even as someone coming from those community, I take that as the norm. It's taken COVID-19 and probably where I am in my life, as I've said, for me to consider, well, should this be the norm? That my own internal discrimination and prejudice, because this is just taken for granted. And I think we've got to celebrate the fact that palliative care kind of came out of this country, how we've worked so hard to develop it. It's been really difficult, and we've been able to take something as a concept that was seen as an add-on and we're still trying really hard to make it cool business, but we have, and that is a great thing that we've done. And this, I guess, is kind of reflecting on that and going, well, actually, what do we do to change from our focus on providing, well, equal care for people, and instead of thinking of how do we produce equity, how do we see that there are certain people within our communities who are at a greater disadvantage. We do have limited resources, so these are really difficult decisions to make, but how do we ensure that we are providing a service that ensures equity, and not just that the people who are able to have a privilege and an advantage in the system, i.e. they know the system, they are able to advocate for themselves, are able to access a service that is excellent, that is recognised, I think, as well, at a national scale. I think at the moment that really is recognised, that we need to focus on equity. But how we do that absolutely can't be an add-on. And I guess that's, I consider it from my perspective, I think we really need to unravel some of the fabric that makes up our services at the moment and rebuild it in order to genuinely ensure equitable care.
I'm really mindful of a term that we all use, which you referenced in your editorial, which is hard to reach communities. And we say it without thinking about it. We say it because it's accepted terminology. But when we start to unpack that has such paternalistic connotations, doesn't it?
I've used that, probably heard that term in the past and not flinched and thought, you know, that's fine. More recently, obviously, I've reflected on it, and I think what that term says is that there's something about these communities that make them hard to reach, that they are the issue, and there's something additional we need to do to enable them to access our service. So we might, you know, say they're hard to reach community, so we'll have an open day so they can come to the hospice and see what the hospice is about, or we'll ensure we provide, as long as our standard meal, we'll also have something on the menu that's halal or kosher, so they feel that they're part of it. But I think what that doesn't do, firstly, is the key thing that probably has resulted in us not addressing inequalities effectively, is that we don't recognise what are the barriers within ourselves and within our system that stop us hearing what these communities are saying. They're not barricading themselves away. They're not inarticulate. They can speak languages. It might not be your common language, but they can speak and they can tell you their stories. We're all human beings. What are the barriers that we have put in place that stop us from listening to those people? And I guess it comes back to that thing, again, for me, not only ensuring that we listen on a practical sense so we can be at the same table and listen, but also be able to listen and genuinely come from a place where we respect and don't other different cultures, different values, different ways of life. We are really good as minority ethnic groups of picking up whether someone really wants to listen to us. And so it's not so much of just making sure we're at the same table, it's doing that hard work of looking at what are the barriers within myself that stop me from listening. And I think part of that is that we don't operate in multicultural organizations, we don't operate within multicultural teams, especially at the senior level, and we need to do that. I guess it comes back to the core thing of doing the really hard work of valuing different cultures. So I'm in a mixed race, mixed ethnicity marriage. And me and my husband, especially just having the kids more so, because there's something so much more at stake here, you know, I would say on a daily basis come across stuff where we have a different perspective on it, coming from different cultures and different backgrounds. And to really want to create something that truly is multicultural requires that level of hard work and digging in and negotiating and making sure that that other person feels that they're able to speak their mind. Because if you don't enable that within any relationship, that will come out in other insidious ways.
So when you were talking, I was thinking about reflective practice, which hospices are very good at and palliative care teams are very good at, in terms of genuinely taking the space, having supervision, talking through, providing services, what they found personally difficult, being very open about mistakes in a safe place. Do you think we need to extend that to talk about race and to talk about our broader services and to talk about, feel very safe and open in talking about mistakes we may have made, or say, I said this, was it wrong? Or I did this, was it wrong?
I guess I would say, from someone who is from a minority ethnic group, I don't know what to do. I don't know what the right thing is, especially within a system, limited resources. So I work in Bradford. It's really difficult to recruit people from ethnic minority groups. The services have really, really tried. It's really difficult. There are no easy solutions. But I think in terms of understanding our own barriers and how we might contribute to that, I think it is really important that we are able to have those conversations openly and honestly, and not so we can do that learning. I think that's really, really useful.
So what are some of the other practical steps do you think that hospices and palliative care teams need to consider right now? What are some of the things that they can do?
For me, the first step we need to take is to create diversity at the decision-making level, at the service lead level, because I think if we don't have that, it's very difficult to do the listening. I guess it's also an indication to people from those minoritized groups that we take this seriously. This is really important to us. That's not to say that teams that aren't diverse can't listen. In order to do the work, drive it and implement it, I think we need to be able to at least have at those tables people who represent different values, different approaches, different cultures, and be able to listen. And I guess I've been reflecting on that most recently, because I've recently applied for a consultant post, and one of the things that struck me was that, you know, people said the most important thing for you to go for this kind of post is you need to pick your colleagues. They're the most important things. But the other thing I also heard was that the most important thing that people will be looking for you on the day is if you fit in. And that, as someone from a minority group, makes me feel really vulnerable. I have previously not applied for posts and other positions because of that reason, because there's another candidate who will be a better fit. I think we need to really consider those kind of things when we're making decisions and we're employing people at a board and senior level, those people who get the final say of how much resource and time and energy we put into creating equitable services. That is probably starting at the hardest side, but if we're not going to do that, if we're not willing to buy in at that level, then you're not really going to change anything. If we're willing to make change at that level, then people are really willing to make the changes necessary. And it's that kind of level of subtle things that we might just take for granted. But actually, for people coming from a minoritized group, those things make a big difference. I think, as well as that, we talked about listening. And again, for me, listening, part of that active listening is taking the time to do that hard work, to look at our own privileges and our own prejudices and how that might influence our ability to really listen to what people need. And I guess the other thing we haven't really talked about, how these communities, you know, we can use the word communities, and that has kind of become an othering term, because part of this community, and or disadvantaged communities or deprived communities similarly. And coming from those communities, you know, I would come from what would be classed as a disadvantaged community. I never saw that growing up. It's only more recently I look back and go, oh gosh, actually, if you looked at the data, we would be classed as a disadvantaged community. But what we saw was the richness, the neighbourliness, the you know, friendships that form within those communities. I feel much more comfortable driving around inner city Bradford than I do around the outskirts, because I see something different. And that, again, I guess, illustrates to me why you need that diversity. We see things from a different lens. But also, there's this thing of considering these groups of people of having a problem, being a problem that we need to solve, even with the, even in good faith. Time and time again, when I've gone out of my way to speak to people from the community, what they've said is, you get people coming in, they want to do a research project, they get their data and they go, and nothing changes. And I think hospices that may have a disadvantaged community within their, you know, within their patch, but aren't necessarily embedded within those communities, again, it could be, well, I know I'm part of this, but am I really part of it? And what are you going to do? And I think it's important that it's kind of, we do refer, it's not a done to, it's rather than like, how do we do this with you? Making sure that we kind of promote people from the community and fund them and resource them to do the research that they want to do, and instead of funding outside agencies that might have historically have had done big projects and done stuff that's been really good, but actually perhaps aren't going to invest in these communities, aren't going to go out of their way to really focus on what is going to make the difference in this particular place for this particular community. It's challenging, it's difficult, we're going to make mistakes. Trying to develop interventions that are going to reduce inequalities, we're going to make mistakes. So we need to test them, modify them, evaluate them, because we do work in a system with limited resources. So we need to know what is the most effective ways to reduce inequality. So I think the research aspect of it is really important. But again, we need to do it in a way that really engages communities, really values them and really listens to them, because I'm sure if we keep doing what we've done so far, we're not going to get the same. We're going to get the same outcome, which is that we still have considerable inequalities.
I'm mindful of the fact that often people will access hospice or palliative care quite late. And also thinking about your experience growing up with primary care, in that a lot of the experiences and lack of trust will have built up over years. So I'm wondering if hospice and palliative care teams need to really think about doing some of this work in partnership, perhaps with GPs, community pharmacies, for example, and doing some broader initiatives. One of the conversations I had with a chief executive of hospice really stopped me short recently, and she was talking to me about some focus groups they've done. There was a lady in the focus group saying she wasn't going to access palliative care because she didn't want to be put on a register or have any kind of treatment and acknowledge the fact she was dying, because she thought her children would be taken away because she didn't trust the state. And another said, I know I'm only allowed to be in this country if I'm economically viable, if I'm going over and above, if I'm adding something to the country. If you put me on your end of life list, I'll be deported. Nobody will want me to be here. Nobody will want to spend the money on me. I was so ashamed that there are people living in this country that feel like that, and they clearly do feel like that. So this is bigger than hospice and palliative care. How can we work in partnership, or do you think partnership working is going to be a critical part of this?
People might not feel comfortable accessing specialist services, therefore we need to ensure that the generalist services are there for them. I guess I'm not surprised by hearing those stories. I think, you know, my dad still says and always said to us, one day they're going to kick you out of this country, because, you know, we're always kind of see ourselves as being here in a vulnerable position where people might actually, you know, are we ever going to be considered actually part of this country? And still to date, my dad, you know, worries that we will get kicked. And that is a risk, you know, when you see what's happening nowadays, you can see where that comes from. And I think the other thing that came to mind when you said that is that there are real consequences for those kind of kind of micro consultations that you have throughout someone's healthcare journey, and then sensing whether they can trust you. So for my mum, so she died when she was 50 from an MI. She had symptoms for 3 to 4 weeks going on, but she didn't feel her symptoms were severe enough to go see that GP because the other GP had left the practice because she'd retired. So these individual one-on-one consultations that we have, the service we provide, even if it's not the most consequential kind of part of someone's kind of healthcare, they will have massive impacts for those people. Them not trusting you has massive impacts. Them not feeling secure and safe to come to say, this is how I'm feeling. I'm not sure. I haven't got the language skills to articulate that I think something is wrong with me. Or, you know, I didn't expect that I shouldn't die of pain. You know, I always just thought, well, why would someone want to sort out my pain at end of life? Is that not part and parcel of dying? So creating that safe environment for someone to feel like they are valued. And I know I keep coming back to this, but creating that safety where someone feels safe to be who they are, talk about their values openly is really, really, really important. We can also talk about bereavement. So, you know, very recently I was speaking to a family, Eastern European family clinically, who really were desperate not for their father's CPAP to be removed. He was dying of COVID. And, you know, I just spent a long time listening to all their concerns. And their main concern was, are you sure you've done everything? Because I know that perhaps you might be curtailing things because, you know, you kind of like, he's got severe COVID, that's it. But we need to know, we are desperate to know you've done everything. And so we were able to talk through everything that had been done to date. And they just needed a bit more time. They needed a bit more time to just feel at ease that we had done everything. So giving them that extra 24 to 48 hours. But for him, it was also really important that his daughters were okay and that they felt at peace that everything had been done. So he was willing to take that for them. And I think sometimes we can get stuck in this, well, we need to make sure that this patient, it's their wishes, it's what's right for them. But you know, again, in palliative care, we need to understand how culturally that might manifest differently for different people, and providing that kind of culturally safe care where they feel able to say that it's really, really important to us that you keep going for another day. You know, that will really impact us. And they didn't feel, in honesty, they didn't feel that they had the right to say that. They felt like they had to fight for it in other ways. And that was creating more issues on the ward than just actually listening to them and saying, well, actually, if this is that important to you, then that's really important, because it's going to impact bereavement massively. Yeah. And again, often in these communities, that kind of feeling that no one listened to you is internalized. It might not come through complaints, because you think at a system level, why are they going to listen to people from our community? They don't care about our community. And those things like systematically wear away at that trust.
Listening to all of that, we can see where all these health inequalities are coming from, that it's impacting on life expectancy, that it's clearly impacting on how effective pain management can be delivered, on symptom control. And so we cannot live with the status quo. We cannot do nothing when we can see post-COVID, especially the impact that we're having on people who are non-white in terms of accessing good palliative end-of-life care. And given the fact that that is happening to such a large part of our society, day in, day out, we cannot allow the status quo to continue. So I think what I've heard through this conversation is that although we know we're very nice in hospice and palliative care, although we know we're trying our best, although we know that we're working extremely hard, we cannot allow this to continue, because we're basically living now in a pandemic of inequality. Would you agree, Jamila?
Yeah, it's also recognizing that this isn't a quick win. So there's a lot of knee-jerk reaction to say we need to address inequality now. This needs to be a priority. But again, if you don't work on increasing diversity at the top level, ensuring that we are doing a lot of listening and ensuring that we're doing co-production with our communities, and that requires a lot of hard work to rebuild that trust, so you've got the people whose actual voices you want to hear rather than, you know, just community leaders. All of this takes a long-term strategy and a lot of hard work collecting the evidence, and it's not a quick win. And so it's focusing the resources on that longer term strategy rather than trying to do something quick as a quick win to tick that box.
And all of the things that will make that strategy work are things like good data collection and evidence collection, good strong partnership working, working within the ICS, looking at broader funding. So what I'm getting out of this conversation is it will be very easy to say that we need an equality and diversity strategy, but actually maybe we need to look at our overall strategy. This is not about something niche on the side. It's not about tackling equality and diversity. It's taking a brand new look at what we're trying to do as hospice and palliative care teams, how we serve our communities, and making sure it's embedded in our 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, 10-year strategies.
I think that's my feeling. And obviously there's lots of competing demands. There's lots of things going on. There's lots of things we need to tackle. The pandemic has thrown up workforce issues, funding issues. So I think we need to really prioritise it, because if it's not prioritised, it's not going to get done, because there'll always be competing demands. There always has been. I always come back to, we need the decision makers to at least have people who are really going to champion that and see it through.
Well, thank you so much, Jamila. I feel as though we've covered an awful lot in our conversation today, and it really is, I think, the start of a big change in hospice and palliative care. I think what conversations like this will do is give people the confidence to be able to engage in something that can be quite worrying, that they might feel that they don't have the experience, that hopefully after listening, they can feel as though they can have those conversations, they can reach out, they can take some risks, because that will ultimately pay off in working together in partnership to better help people across our country access good quality hospice and palliative care. And ultimately, that's what we're all here for. So thank you so much for the discussion today, Jamila. I think it will make a big difference.
Thank you for the opportunity.